We're at the Estancia Hotel and Spa, just down the street from the Salk Institute, where tomorrow we'll be having the 7th annual stem cell meeting on the Mesa. We met, this is Alan Trounson, who's president of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. We met at the Science Network's first public event, which was also held in the same auditorium, October 2nd, 2004, 1 month before Proposition 71 passed, as a result of which CIRM, your agency, was formed with $3 billion from taxpayers.
So
one of the things I'd like to know is, in that period, what do you think has happened? What have been the promises? Have they been realized? What are the prospects? Just give me some sort of overview of that very fertile period that we've been through.
So Roger, there was 2 years where nothing happened, really, because they were in court defending the proposition. So nothing really happened until the latter part of 2006. So it's even a shorter time. At the end of 2006, a loan from Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger enabled some funding to go out for the original traineeships. And since then, the program has begun. Now, I joined at the very end of 2007, so I've been there 5 years. And in that time, it's been extraordinary. You know, we have actually set in place a program, basic science program, which is second to none in stem cells and regenerative medicine worldwide. And it's really the funds that have been driving that. But also, the scientists in California have really responded in an incredible way. They, first of all, rejigged their interests to go from, a non-stem cell-based interest into stem cell research in large numbers. They also brought colleagues with them. They changed fields. And then there was the opportunity for creating new institutes, which we did. We built 12 new institutes. We were able to get a lot of co-funding for that. We spent $270 million, but we received $540 million in private donor money, as well as other institutional money, to bring it up to over $1 billion for those 12 institutes. They house thousands of scientists across California. So the infrastructure was built in the early days, the scientific infrastructure, the capacity to really turn this field on dramatically as a science. It's changed science and cell biology dramatically. And there are just major developments in place that we can talk about that have really sort of changed everything. But more importantly, I think right now, is we're also engaging with the translational developments to make it clinically applicable.
One of the things that was an initial area of dispute, I mean, I remember that our original meeting was called Stem Cells, Science, Ethics and Politics at the Crossroads. And obviously when this first started, the ethics was a major part of it. I don't know whether that's gone away completely or whether the progress has soothed people's fears. What would you say?
Well, I don't think the basic underlying difficulties that some people have with embryonic stem cells has gone away, but nor is the concern about in vitro fertilization gone away essentially. But the community, I think, has embraced the whole concept that they are able to generally accept the development of, first of all, in vitro fertilization, and then the use of those spare embryos for developing embryonic stem cells for clinical purposes, for making a difference in health. So that has been accepted by the community. And if you look at the major reports on people's views now, it's kind of over 65%, close to 70% of people who will accept embryonic stem cell research, even cloning for embryonic stem cell research, right across the United States, and I think it's even higher in California. So that's an enormous vote of confidence. But there are still some people who have those concerns, and I think they will always have the concerns about abortion, about embryonic stem cells, about in vitro fertilisation and so on. So that won't, it won't disappear. So you will find some conservative people or people who have religious beliefs that a person exists in the point of fertilisation. That will always be the case, I think. But we've actually been able to address many of the follow-on concerns because it, you know, with the development of induced pluripotential stem cells by Shinya Yamanaka and Thompson and others, we've been able to utilise the information derived from what an embryonic stem cell is and how it functions to creating almost the equivalent from an adult cell, fat cell, blood cell, a skin cell. So this has made an enormous difference, I think, because there's at least the alternative pathway. But you have to remember that just 2 weeks ago, a Japanese group published on turning a skin cell into an iPS cell, into an egg, and produced baby mice, and those baby mice were healthy. So an iPS cell is essentially no different to an embryonic stem cell. Absolutely not. It has the same potentiality. So, you know, we are captured by the conundrum that if you develop these things, you will also expose the argument. And so I think my contention that the majority, the vast majority of people in the world and in the United States support embryonic stem cells means that they will also support all of the follow-on technologies.
You mentioned other technologies that preceded this. You mentioned in vitro fertilization, for example. And it says here on your Wikipedia entry that as you were in Australia, which is where you came from, of course, he introduced two world-first procedures which greatly improved the success rate of in vitro fertilization, IVF. There were the use of a fertility drug to induce multiple ova and the freezing of embryos for future use. And these procedures enabled more than 300,000 women worldwide to conceive successfully. Now, let me just go on a little bit because my memory is, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the first test tube baby, which this is the technology we're talking about here, was done by Patrick Steptoe and his right. colleague, Robert Edwards. Mm-hmm. And there's first test tube baby, Louise Joy Brown, born in 1978, still hale and hearty as far as I know. And you go back to that period, and did you know Steptoe? You worked with Steptoe?
Yeah, well, I knew Bob Edwards. I was in Cambridge between 1974 and 1977. And I knew Bob Edwards, who was at the Marshall Labs in Cambridge. I was working in Huntington Road with, I was on an animal scientists at that time, very interested in cattle, horse, sheep, pig reproduction, using embryology as the main tool, IVF embryology. And so I hadn't met Patrick Steptoe at that time, but Bob Edwards was driving up to Oldham to do his work. Now, before I went to Cambridge, I was approached by Carl Wood, who was the gynecologist obstetrician in Melbourne, who had really come independently to the view that IVF was a better way of helping to solve female infertility, principally blocked tubes, rather than trying to build artificial tubes for women, rather take the egg, take the sperm and put it together in the laboratory. And he came to see me as a PhD student and my supervisor in a place called Jerilderie, which was way out in western New South Wales, where we were working on thousands of sheep for our experiments, to look at what we were doing. And he was convinced to travel along the same direction, and he offered me a job before I went to Cambridge, and I declined. I wanted to go to Cambridge to really learn about science. But during that time that I was there, the Ford Foundation that was supporting Robert Edwards for his work in IVF transferred their support to Carl Wood and his colleagues in Melbourne. So they got a big Ford Foundation grant that was in the area of contraception, really developing inhibin contraception. IVF was attached to that. They didn't really believe in IVF, I don't think, But there was a, as part of that, they had to nominate some scientists to come back to Australia, and I was one of those. So there was a position for me to come back. My wife wanted to go back to Australia, my first wife, Sue, and so we returned in 1977 to go back to help Carl Wood develop human IVF. And I came along as the basic animal scientist with that expertise. So I joined the laboratory, and I had some problems in the beginning because there was already somebody working in embryology there for Carl who really wanted to govern everything that they were doing. And so when Edwards and Steptoe announced they'd had a pregnancy, Wood came to see me and said he and I should really put our foot forward and see what we could do.
Well, it says here you made headlines in 1980 with the first IVF birth in Australia.
That's correct. So what happened is the first IVF birth in Australia was done in the natural cycle. And we were trying to follow Edwards and Steptoe's program of predicting exactly when the egg would be released in the woman. So this could be any time of the day or night, and we're up trying to follow this. And I thought, that doesn't make sense. I've worked in the animal side, and I know you can control it. You can superovulate the animal. You can control the time of ovulation. So we could actually predict the whole thing. And I asked Wood if I could do those experiments with another gynecologist, John Leeton, and he agreed that I could go off to the side and do it. That's what worked. So after the first two in Britain and the one baby that was born in Australia from the natural cycles, the next 14 babies were all produced using this superovulation, controlled ovulation system. And that is the method that's now used for the 5 million babies that have been produced worldwide.
It also says here that you went on, and there's a nice connection here, obviously, where you led the team which discovered that nerve stem cells could be derived from embryonic stem cells. So now we're into stem cells.
Right.
We moved from...
So I went. So I took an interest in human embryonic stem cells, basically because I was interested in differentiation. How does this undifferentiated cells actually move into an integrated organism and produce all these differentiated cells that are necessary? All the different lineages are necessary to compose an organism. And if you're looking at IVF, you can only go so far. We can only go in the human, say 6 days before. Then it really wasn't able to be sustained in the laboratory. So I thought, like in the mouse, Martin Evans had shown that you could take those inner cell mast cells from the blastocyst stage embryo in the mouse and grow them out as embryonic stem cells. So I couldn't do those actual experiments in Melbourne because by that time we'd made too many advances and they were sort of concerned we were too far ahead of the whole field in terms of getting technologies to advance. So there'd been a sort of turn down on us. I actually went to Singapore and worked with Arif Bongso in Singapore to develop human embryonic stem cells in the mid-90s. And when I was there, we actually were successful. And it's interesting that we had the embryonic stem cells in the laboratory when we got the paper from James Thompson as referees. And of course, we supported it. We knew we had the cells, but we hadn't done the full characterization, made the teratomas and so forth. So we gave him a big tick, but then we pushed on to show that you could drive those cells in a neuron. So we continued the work on and then published that at 2000, showing that you could not only derive the cells, so support James Thompson's studies critically, then also direct the cells into the neuronal lineage, which we thought was a significant step at that time.
Hmm. And then, of course, Singapore since then has became a major place for stem cell work as well. And to skip back a little bit, born, grew up in Australia, obviously, but what got you into science in the first place? It's usually a teacher or a book or parents.
I mean, as a child, I only wanted to be a farmer, you know, and I went to an agricultural high school, a government agricultural high school, when I was 11. And so I was there for 5 years.
11?
11 years of age. From 11 till 16, I was at in a boarding school.
Right. Okay.
And I learned to play football very well, swim very well. Studied reasonably well when it was demanded. I actually, to the surprise of my teachers, did very well in the end examination. They had kind of given up on me, saying the guy's a sportsman and likes to enjoy life, but he'll never really be an academic. And I got a very good pass, that allowed me a choice of going to university. So nobody's bought me a farm at this stage, because, you know, you can only be a farmer if you have a farm or you go and manage a farm. So I decided I really wanted to be a veterinarian, but I got all these scholarships to be a wool technologist. And Australia at that time was riding on the back of the sheep. Wool was a massive export for Australia. It was really the golden fleece that has made Australia such a promising place to live. You know, the economy was driven by sheep. So I became a wool technologist because they gave me these scholarships, very good scholarships. I promptly lost them in the first year because I played a lot of football and enjoyed myself a little bit too much. I regained them the second year and got on with life. But what induced me to become a scientist, I think, was the teachers around me, both, I think at high school, that I was interested in biology, very interested in the animal side of things. When I went to university, wool technology, there was only 11 people in our course in my year, and I think only about 50 in the whole course. So we had access to the lecturers, the teachers, that was extraordinary. You could go talk to them in a one-to-one whenever you liked. And so this was a real privilege, I think, being at university, to go and, you know, really be schooled and be educated in a way which was much more like a one-on-one situation. So I went into physiology and genetics, and I loved it, both of those disciplines. And I ended up, you know, then running a field station, a research field station for the university, way out in the western districts of New South Wales, where they were doing sheep breeding experiments, mostly genetics or drought feeding. So here I was enjoying my science as a young man, enjoying life and seeing, you know, that there are incredible things happening all the time in science that can take you into very interesting situations. I had animals that produced multiple births, and I needed to understand what it was. Was it because the uterus was better at having multiple lambs in it, or did the ovary produce more eggs? So I went to Neil Moore, who was another scientist, had been doing embryo transfer in sheep, and I said, I'd like to do this experiment with you, and we get the eggs out and do the transfers between highly fecund sheep and low fecund sheep, and sort of work this out, which we did together. And I realised, now I'm liking science more and more and more. So I gravitated in that kind of way.
So having been through there, having gone through the academic career, the research career, and ending up at CIRM, where I assume you're not doing much bench work at the moment, you must be just doing mostly plane work and travelling and so on, and being an evangelist in some sense. Or am I putting words in your mouth? I mean,
no. I'm not a bench scientist anymore. That was one of the conditions of the appointment. So when Bob Klein offered me the appointment, which was a shock to me, I didn't know what he was offering me in the first place. I had to ask somebody else at the table, what was he talking about? I first of all thought I had a family, a partner from Sweden who'd come to Australia, and I'd turned her into an Australian. And I thought to myself, what's Karen going to say? You know, now you've turned me into Australian, now you want to turn me into an American? Yeah. What kind of person are you? She didn't do that, but that's what I thought. And then I thought, in Australia, normally you have to retire at the age of 65, you know, down tools, out the door, and get into retirement. I was in my early 60s at that time, and I thought, here's a chance. Klein's offering me a chance to run a revolution in medicine, where I stay at Monash University, I had grants, I was very well supported. I could get another couple of Cell papers, Nature papers, and, you know, enjoy that. That's a very big difference between running a revolution in innovation and satisfying yourself about something that you'd already achieved. I'd already done that a few times. And so I felt that this was an opportunity to do something which was dramatically different. And so he gave me that opportunity. And so I persuaded everyone around me that this was a wonderful thing to do. And I'm a person, I think, who will, if you half open a window, I'll go through it. I'm interested in innovation. I'm interested in what's the pasture that's greener across the way. I'm interested in research that has applications, and I think that was a reason why they were interested in me, because I'd use my science to be creative for in vitro fertilisation. It was a good example. I'd also set up 7 companies, 5 of which still survive and have done very well. So, you know, I had a history of achieving things in some of the areas that they were interested in getting this revolution started in stem cells. So here I am essentially saying, okay, well, I have to down tools, but my value to the organisation is that I'm a peer amongst those people still, because I care about what they're doing. I remain well informed about what they're doing, and I'm supportive of what they're doing. And what I'm doing at CIRM is forever being, again, creative, being flexible, being enabling. And I think they appreciate that. So they get somebody who understands the field, who wants to be innovative, who wants to turn this not into just what was a revolution back in 2004 or what it might have been, but the revolution today is a dramatically different one and very, very important. But I'm able to move with the times. So I think they appreciate the sort of interest that I bring to creativity and interests, and have endorsed that.
As you look back, though, on the decisions you made that created your particular personal trajectory, I mean, do you remember the book by Sir Peter Medawar, Advice to a Young Scientist? What is your advice to a young scientist?
Well, I think, I mean, if there's anyone I'd like to sit down with, is Peter Medawar, absolutely. And, you know, I think everybody should read his book, everyone who begins in science. I think you ought to read it after you've been in science a while, and then you should probably read it at the end. You may not agree entirely with Peter, but I think you'll agree pretty much majority with Peter. I think you have to remain involved. I think you have to be a scientific person. So does that mean that you always have to do the experiments? I don't think that's the case, because most of the really good scientists that I know tend to be more office-based, but they've seeped into it. They're not doing the actual pipetting on the bench. What they're doing is taking the ideas and challenging them or making the observation, or connecting them, or making the introductions. That's what I think I'm doing. I'm up at that level, being enabling for the young scientists to do their thing, and enabling some of the established scientists to continue to do the things that they want to do. So I think I'm in sync with Peter in a way. But I'm not exactly doing it, the way he lays out in that book. But I read his book. I loved it. I loved the man. I loved his ideas, and I think everybody who claims to be a scientist should think about the way they do their work.
One of the things that I've noticed recently is large institutions like Howard Hughes, funding institutions like Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and the Wellcome followed suit. Are beginning to award grants to labs, to established lab heads. And there was a worry voiced at the time, well, so who's going to support the younger scientists who are coming into the field if just the stars are getting more money? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I have a concern that, as you see, the age of first grant rising with the NIH. You know, I think it's well and truly into your mid, if not later 40s. Now, You know, that means that you've got to stay a dependent scientist for a lot longer than you used to have to do. And I think it is much, much more competitive to make your way in science these days. I think the award to established scientists is probably a very smart idea. They're likely to be the kind of people who will be more productive, most productive, if you like. One hopes that they see that they can actually encourage, enable, be the mentor for those younger people, and give and step back and give more as time goes on. Some people are better than others at that. And I think we'll have to wait and see in due course what happens. I do note in Canada that their medical research is really driven by 13 institutes, so they compose the executive of the funding, and so you've basically got there a group of 13 institutes and their primary researchers who are driving the research programs there. It's different in the US. You are given a chance to compete, and there are younger entry points. And here with CERM, we've been open to try and keep those young people coming.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, you've given us some good, nice new development awards.
Yeah.
Which sets up the whole notion of the relationship between science and society. One of the questions I always ask is, when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. What is the rightful place of science?
Well, I think the rightful place in science is to be integrated with the entire community. And the problem a bit there is that scientists tend to think of themselves as unique, and I think rather precious at times, and that, you know, they're not often out there engaged with the general community. It's not a bad idea to explain your work in a way which the community can understand. You might find that they're much more thoughtful and more supportive of research funding flowing, you know, if you did. And so, you know, I've had to communicate because of IVF. You know, this was an area where the community had a real problem. So as you pointed out earlier, I had to get in there and have those debates, have those discussions with the community. Now, I learned by making some errors, but also by learning to help people understand really what was the real interest of the community in the work that we were doing. And it was, of course, going to cross across a place where religion had some problems, and I mean only some religions, but they had really severe problems. And others, like, you know, the feminists thought that this was just a way of men taking over the role of women, and that was strange and surprising. But I understood that if you didn't communicate well, you were going to split off people who would be major critics and could influence the community. Now, I think we required as scientists to help people understand what we're trying to do and why we're doing it. It's not simply for our own sakes. It has a greater reward for the entire community. And it's our business to explain that, and I think you do that very well. But I think many of us have really never got to that kind of level.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Think about it. The great philosopher Spinoza used to wear a ring, which he used to put in wax and then sign off all his letters. And it had a rose in the middle of it, had his initials, BDS. But it also had underneath it the word caute in Latin, which basically means be cautious, be careful, proceed carefully. Now, in a recent issue of Cell Stem Cell, I mean, here's another outcropping of the whole stem cell industry. There's a whole journal called Cell Stem Cell, which is quite wonderful. And in July of this year, they celebrated their 5th anniversary, and there were a lot of commentary papers. One of them by Irv Weissman from Stanford. And it's a paper that is cauté, it's cautious, and it's basically saying, while I'm usually an optimist, I must admit there's a possibility that we'll continue to be in the dark ages of medicine for quite some time. I fear that therapies using purified tissue, organ-specific stem cells will remain elusive. And he goes on to cite a number of issues that worry him, and he finishes off by saying, so whom have I failed to annoy here? typical Weissman. And one of the things also that he mentions is an unexpected but potent barrier business development. He worries that there's a conflict of goals, of companies making profits and that of the biomedical research to advance medical science. Is that all to the benefit of patients? He actually says something nice about CIRM then. But these careful critiques, how do you respond to that?
I think we always need critiques, and that's the one good thing about science. So we don't mind the critic talking to the critic. I mean, we actually enjoy the debate about, you know, whether your hypothesis is the correct hypothesis given the evidence that you produce. So there are some mighty debates amongst great science statesmen that I've listened to over the time, and I've been involved. You know, I think the very first lecture I ever gave as a young student, a senior professor got up and told me this was the greatest load of drivel that he'd ever read, and it ought to be sort of subject to the incinerator. And so, you know, you have to be able to take criticism and be responsive to it. And I think it's necessary to be critical or have critics. Essentially, that's the only way you can actually improve upon what you're doing. So first of all, I think being cautious is very important. I think it's, you have to be an optimist, really, as a scientist. So we all sort of, we're including Earth, we're all on the optimistic side, quite often over-optimistic, because we're driven, because, you know, we feel that there's something there and we want to be able to show it. And I've argued that even in the instance of you showing something important, that's not the end of the game, really. And I put it to journals like Cell, Stem Cell, Nature and Science, that they ought to have a section of, you know, interesting new developments. That is one of some of these unexpected papers come out, but also a section that says an independent laboratory reproduced it, because if you do, and if you do that twice, it's as good as fact. But there's plenty of papers that never get reproduced, often in some of these very top journals. Why is that? Is it because we haven't been cautious enough? We haven't done the right experiments? Were we really, really lucky to do something that showed something but nobody ever could reproduce it? There are plenty of them if you go look. So being cautious, I think, is important for science generally. Being critical is really, really important. Let's be critical, let's be self-critical if we can, but also let's be critical of one another, because that way we're actually going to arrive at the truth. And so I embrace that kind of thinking, and I'll spend a lot of time on the river talking with Irv about those kind of things, because, you know, we're in sync with it, essentially. And I disagree with some things, that he said, which you should. I actually think business needs to be involved with us.
Well, let me make that point, because this is also not only the 7th annual scientific symposium, it's the 2nd annual investor and partnering forum. Right. So business is here. I mean, it seems rather obvious that you can't just leave Critical. Everything in a laboratory. It has to get
Critical.
Out there somehow. That's right. Otherwise,
well, the public's not going to pay for everything. Essentially, if you want to have safety and efficacy demonstrated in a regulatory manner, and that's what the community has decided, and I think it's an extremely good idea to do that. It takes money to do it. It takes a lot of money, unfortunately, to get that work done. And so very often, most of all, we have to look to private funding in some ways. So this is either shareholders or well, you know, well-credentialed people who have money have to make a contribution. The problem that IRV has is one of his work being turned off by a company that took over his work at one time. He saw that was the only way for that company to go forward, and they just they dropped all of his work in because it didn't really suit their business program at the time. So that's the problem. So my advice to IRV is clearly you've got to engage business, but it'd be a really smart idea if you ended up as chairman of the board, because then they wouldn't easily trash one of your really good ideas. So I think we have to make adjustments, all of us, to really welcome the community is generally shareholders, and once you become public companies, people invest in that. So the community is investing in it. So we're actually enjoining again the community in another way. And so I think it's a really important thing to do. But I'm not satisfied to leave it kind of in the way it is. I think we've got to go on and do many more things. I think we've got to create stem cell clinics in California, and I'm determined to get that done next year. A network of clinics that can actually deliver these cell therapies, because some of them are autologous. Some of them you're going to need to go to the clinic. People need advice about their diseases. They're actually getting very very bad advice from the internet about where to go, often overseas, right, to the wrong place, rather lose their money.
Sketchy operation. Yeah.
Just not good. So, but if you can have independent counsellors in these networks that say, hang on, there's a trial running here or somewhere else that we might be able to qualify you for, or just wait because, you know, you've got a problem that really is intractable at the moment, and there is no other treatment. So if you want to use your money to get something that won't work, you can do that, but it's not a very good idea. So we want to do that. I also want to CIRM is going to end one day, right? We've got $3 billion. It doesn't stretch to eternity, I assure you. So for California, if I don't do something special here, California is going to look down a cliff, which is going to be catastrophic for science in the state, I believe. You've seen these cliffs before. They've happened at NIH and they've happened at other places, which means the bulk of the funding that was keeping the science healthy and rolling forward suddenly disappears. So I'm looking at another mechanism, and I'm not suggesting that will be necessary to go back and ask for another proposition, but I think there are mechanisms that will enable us to move forward and soften that cliff, at least soften it, or maybe be able to continue CIRM in a different guise going forward. And so I want to work on that proposition in the next few years.
Using public funding or
combination.
Depending more on
a
industry.
Combination.
Yeah.
I think we have to use some public funding, but I think I would hope we might be able to use a combination of some CIRM funds, but attract in the venture capital people and the well-heeled major companies in the space to come and really help us put something together. And I think it's really possible. So I don't think we should just do the thing simply as we're currently doing. I think we've got to get even more innovative and creative in this space to make it a sustainable and an important deliverable for the whole community.
Is there ever any point at which you consider doing something else instead of being a frustrated sheep farmer or something? Well, I suppose you did think about that, didn't you?
No, I'm actually, you know, my family all lives in Australia, so I live in the United States. This is not an optimum situation, really, I don't think. You know, I travel back when I can, but it's not that frequent. It's quite a distance. So, yeah, I've thought about some other things, and I'm on a board of a very interesting not-for-profit entity, which is farming in a very different way to what currently the farmers do, and looks at sustainable farming for profit in a totally different way. Now, whether that's something that I'll gravitate to or not, I don't really know at this stage, but yes, I've had thoughts of doing something else. I think there's still a mountain to climb here. If there's not a very important role for me still here at CERM, then there's very good reason I should go back to Australia, engage with the family, and maybe think of doing something else in innovation.
In terms of heroes, influences, I ask another question frequently, which is, if I gave you a time travel token and said that you could bring to your dinner table anybody from any discipline, from any period of history, who would you like to sit down and ask questions of or have a conversation
with? Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela, that's somewhat unexpected, but obviously a great hero, but why?
I don't think I know anybody who is such an extraordinary person. Somebody who could be put through the very worst of personal situations and still come out such an incredibly positive man for everybody. It's a very hard thing to understand how you can be that forgiving, that so positive in the face of so much trauma in one's life. I think 5 minutes with Mandela, or 2 hours with Mandela, or 2 days with Mandela would all be worthwhile for me. I did meet Bishop Tutu, and I did have a conversation. It wasn't a very long one, but I had a very interesting conversation with him. And he was somebody I really, really appreciated too, for a different reason. But it just seemed, you know, those are the kind of people that I'd absolutely love to spend a short while with. I can think of many others, but I think if you ask me who I'd like to sit as preference, it would be Nelson Mandela.
That 5-year anniversary issue of Cell Stem Cell I mentioned, there's also a piece in there by Ole Lindvall. And the title of it is, Why is it taking so long to develop clinically competitive stem cell therapies for CNS disorders? And he starts off by pointing out that some of the first work on Parkinson's was done 3 decades ago. Mm-hmm. Where have we got in treating things like that? So there are lots of CNS brain diseases, if you like, Huntington's and Parkinson's, that affect so many people, especially with a more aging population as well. Where obviously people must be saying, well, what are you guys going to do to help us?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You know. And I've got a sense of frustration with Parkinson's disease. So we're holding a workshop early next year to try and find out what it is that's stopping us from really getting there with some, you know, really new clinical trial work. And I might be wrong, but I think there's some blockages in our knowledge and some lack of real abilities to produce the kind of cells that we need. So number one, I think, is that we don't know enough about it all. We don't really know what's causing the death of those dopamine-producing neurons. We don't. We don't really know a lot about the causes of Alzheimer's disease. We know that multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease, but why the heck are there? Why are we attacking our own myelin? You know, what's going on there? What the heck is that? Huntington's disease I think we're a bit closer to that because we kind of know that that's a gene defect, and there's some pretty interesting attacks coming on that and that. And I think on a molecular basis, they sound good sense to me. You know, I think we will be successful at holding back that disease, if not holding it back for 20 years. That might be a lifetime, right, for most people. So where I'm frustrated is that with Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, we do not know enough is the problem, and we don't know the kind of cell that we want to put in there or the kind of drug that we need to put in there, and drug or cell. We just don't know. And we really haven't made a great deal of advance on the therapeutic side. The knowledge is been increasing all the time, but we still haven't got there. So I want to know from all the people around the world what they think the problem is, so that organisations like ours can actually focus on those particular problems and see if we can understand and resolve those and enable us to move forward, because these must be diseases which we can treat. They must be. And we've just got to understand what's necessary to do it. So Ollie's absolutely right. I mean, he's been in there for such a long time. He does say this is way too long. And he does say, you know, we need to know more. And we need to be brave in finding those problems and then getting on and doing the right clinical trials, or as right as we can make them. And we need to be doing that. And we need to be doing that in the next, let's say, 3, 4, 5 years, because otherwise it could be another 30 years before we make an advance on it, right? It's not good enough. We need to do it now, and we need to find the problems, and we need to be able to resolve them, and we need to bring all our pressure to bear. So Mahendra Rao at the NIH, convinced we should do it. I'm convinced. Most of the people in the world are convinced. Let's meet together and put the pressure on the places that need to do to resolve this. And let's have a clinical trial, or a number of them, in the next 3 years, that maybe people will recover from this disease.
So, last question then, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about a lot of things. I'm optimistic we've got a cure for HIV/AIDS. I think there are two clinical trials coming up which we're funding. One of them I expect to have approval pretty soon, or imminently. Another within a year, and we're going to attack that disease by wrecking the CCR5 gene, the co-receptor for the virus. And there's some proof of concept already that works with a patient, and I think we can show that we can cure HIV/AIDS, and I'm optimistic about that. And we need to get it into the clinical trials. I thought one of the big problems might be the residual virus in the gut. You know, that's really hard to get it out of the gut. But the animal studies are now showing that if you actually disrupt that CCR5 gene, you also lose the virus from the gut reservoirs, which, so you got it out of the blood, out of the gut. There's a chance that these patients will no longer have the disease. And these people in Northern Europe that have got the disrupted genes, so both alleles disrupted, they never get the disease. They never get it. And there's none of those people in Africa. So they must have been exposed somewhere in Northern Europe in time to a disease that's left that group of people with that mutation in place, right? So I think it's a great case. The thing I would like to do, if I still can, is to move the research to the next step and say, look, I want to do it in situ, in the patient, like a vaccine strategy. And let's go after that disease. Let's go into Africa and eradicate it. You know, you can't eradicate it using the technique that we're going to evolve, because it means taking out your hematopoietic stem cell, your blood stem cell, and actually mutating that and putting it back. That's not going to work for the whole of Africa. But the researchers show that you can actually do it in vivo, in animals. So I think we ought to get on and move this the next step forward. Now, so what I'm saying is, if we did that alone,
Roger. CIRM would have been worthwhile. But I think we've got cures for sickle cell disease and thalassemia. I think for blindness. I think for type 1 diabetes. All coming into clinical trial. I'm very optimistic that most, if not all of those, will show that they're very effective. And so, yeah, I think I'm going to sit down and say, that was a good experiment.
Alan Trounson, thanks very much.